I have studied, once gave a talk on the psychology of collecting and collectors. I saw a very dark reflection in the mirror. And if not for a good psychopharmacologist, I might not have left my bed. There's actually, it was a good piece of research. They brought collectors into a room individually and they said, your mother's life were a black patty, thereby establishing that collectors do not have Oedipal issues. We're about to meet a very astonishing collector, because the truth of the matter is that as pathological as most of us are, the thing is that society and the saving of sound owes so, so much to collectors, and the gentleman we're about to meet is one of the world's greatest and most prolific and public collectors, and unless he has fooled me completely, he seems remarkably emotionally stable. His name is B. George. He's had a varied career over the years. He now presides over this remarkable archive of contemporary music, and that is ARC capitalized, Archive of Contemporary Music, as co-founder and executive director, though I think you may have moved on to something else. This archive has more than 2 million records. It's been characterized as the largest popular music collection in America. Again, we will be cautious about superlatives, but he may persuade you. It began with B's own collection, comprising 47,000 discs. He's also done a discography on punk and new wave music, and among other themes, he'll be speaking to the daunting challenge of cataloging large collections, and we do mean large. And he has a number of other interesting initiatives going. So, B, take it away.
Okay, I think we're going to race, and I'm going to read, and you're going to rather do a point-by-point PowerPoint kind of presentation. I'm just going to show a fuzzy film. We don't have an IT department, and hopefully you'll hear some music if they put it in the right place. Need to go through there? Sound people?
Okay.
Come on. Okay. You're hearing Fela Kuti, a musician from Nigeria, and he'll be playing with us all day today. I'm going to touch on three things: what the archive does and how we built it, new alliances that we're building now to help with our continued growth, and some cataloging projects initiatives. You're moving through the archive. This is 500,000 LPs that you'll be seeing. The archive is now in its 23rd year of operation with over 2 million recordings and arguably the largest collection of popular music in the world. We only collect two copies of every commercial release that we can find. Popular music for us is anything composed, or anything that's not classical era Western art music. That's roughly things that were composed from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War. Technically, we begin the collection with LPs, anything that's essentially microgroove recordings, LPs, 45s, about the time of the invention of the American teenager. The arc begins in 1985 when we couldn't find another institution willing to accept my collection of 47,000 recordings. What I had at the time was mostly punk, hip hop, and reggae material. And we were told this wasn't music and it wasn't worth saving. That basically, I'd accumulated this material because I was a radio and a club DJ, and I was doing a monthly radio show for with John Peel from the BBC as part of their programming. And I was a DJ in the UK in clubs and then along the Mediterranean coast. And I had also released the first recording by a performance artist named Laurie Anderson. It was called Oh Superman. And for 6 years, I directed Laurie's stage show. This song became a number two hit in the UK and number one in 20 countries. I also authored a book called Volume, which was called The International Discography of the New Wave, which is a 700-page book that basically took a comprehensive look at this material, and we ended the date in 81. I also spent 2 years in and out of Jamaica collecting recordings, so that's why this collection had that focus. When no one was interested, including the Library of Congress, we started, found a whole group of people to get together. We recruited a board of well-known musicians. We secured some initial funding. We got donations from the record companies and private collectors. I got letters of support from all the major record companies in America that were based in New York, and that was pretty easy at the time, when there were record companies. And then we started this all in a small loft in Manhattan. Currently, the ARC occupies 15,000 square feet of space in three locations and houses 500,000 LPs, 300,000 CDs, 750,000 12-inch dance and club singles, 350,000 7-inch singles, several thousand paper records and flexi discs, 3 million press kits, posters, and photos. We don't collect 78s, but accidentally we have about 15,000. And they sort of come in because obviously they reflect the work of a lot of the artists that we begin with in rock and roll and in big bands and jazz and country. Half of the CDs are actually cataloged, a third of the LPs, and something no one else has done, we have cataloged all 350,000 7-inch singles. We have 25,000 music books, 60,000 videos, and over 100,000 music magazines. We catalog using off-the-shelf software. We've designed it so it can easily flow into Mark or any other Sputnik-era-based system. It's unique in our library that we catalog at a song level, so that one of our biggest clients is the Harry Fox Agency, and they keep track of mechanical rights. So about 15% of all of our cataloging will include a song title, the authors, the publishers, and the rights organization. And that's a level I think that not many other libraries really get involved with. I also want to point out we've done this without any government or institutional support of any kind. We have never until last year ever asked for a grant. We survive through membership from people making contributions, from research fees, which is a large part of what we do, and semi-annual sales where we sell off our third copies. Fred Patterson, who's our archivist, he's more like a gardener. Every time something comes in, he goes to the shelf and compares it to the existing copies that we have. Almost all of the recordings are graded by both the condition of the vinyl and the covers, because we do a lot of scanning work. And then mostly we survive by the generous donations of the boards that we've built up. So I want to talk a little bit about that real quick. To help fund the archive and generate publicity and build our collections, we initiated a very high-profile board of advisors. Our board began with legendary producer John Hammond. Our current board includes a lot of, I think, wonderful people who have been very helpful. Songwriters Lieberman Stoller and Ellie Greenwich, film directors Jonathan Demme and Martin Scorsese, producers Jellybean Benitez and Jerry Wexler, performing artists David Bowie, Yusu Nador, Lou Reed, Keith Richards, Nile Rodgers, Todd Rundgren, Fred Schneider, and Paul Simon. And these are the people we ask for money. Beyond the financial support, the board members assist in creating special collections. We ask them to try to find something they're interested in and build a collection that way. To date, the most developed is the Keith Richards Blues Collection. Its numbers some 10,000 discs. Keith helped us buy a very rare Robert Johnson 78, Me and the Devil Blues. There's maybe 10 or 12 of them in the world, and this one's in really excellent condition. And so that's what we do. We try to get them to focus. Jonathan Demme is working on a Haitian collection for us. It's one of his loves. All of the material we get is donated, and we have no acquisitions budget at all. Our approach is really personal. We've sought out and developed relationships with the music industry and with collectors. We can't emphasize enough how our accessibility has led to our growth. If someone calls, I pick up the phone and I talk to them. And I think that's very important. We think of ourselves as the Molly Bloom of collectors. We say yes, yes, yes to just about everything. So we collect, we don't reject any material. We have no interest in quality whatsoever. Beyond cataloging, our most common activity is doing research for the music industry. Mostly we track down publishing information. We reconstruct unavailable audio, we provide fact-checking, we consult on a lot of films, and provide scans of record covers. Thousands of high-res scans of covers are provided annually to the record labels for reissue projects and to magazines and book publishers. We do the music issue for Vanity Fair every year, so whenever people need things, they know they can call us, we're readily accessible, we can answer their questions and tell them immediately if we do or do not have something. We provided the scans for the opening exhibit of the Jazz Hall of Fame at the AOL Time Warner Building, which was part of Jazz at Lincoln Center. And we are currently providing hundreds of scans for the Grammy Hall of Fame that's going to open in Los Angeles. So now, after 20 years of building this collection, 3 years ago I began seeking partnerships that would make the collection available to more users. It made no sense to have all this stuff and not have anyone really using it. July 1st, the archive will merge with Columbia University to create a new center for popular and world music. We believe this is a pioneering commitment by a leading university to the study of popular music. This project is spearheaded by Jim Neal, the head of libraries, which some of you might know, and Greg Mosier, the head of the Columbia Arts Initiative. These are all, by the way, we have 217 fellow records at the library. The goal beyond preservation at this new center is to use music to enrich and enhance course study and to better integrate the university into the local community, New York City, and to the world. One of the deciding factors for Columbia was the range and breadth of our collections, especially stuff like this, the world music material. And we've cataloged 55,000 recordings in this one collection. And I want to point out, anybody who wants to see databases, I have everything with me. You can go through it and look at them, give you an idea of what we do. Again, we use FileMaker. It's off the shelf. It's easy, and it works. The deciding factor for us to do this with Columbia was the promise of the stability and the permanence that the university could provide us. Columbia will build a new center for this collection and expanded activities in the Manhattanville campus in Harlem. And the site proposed is a prime site, 125th Street and Broadway, right near the Apollo. The center will combine aspects of an archive, a library, a digital lab, an educational center, exhibition and performance spaces. Along with housing the archive, we hope to offer space to other orphaned, not-for-profit, music-related businesses in New York City. And there are quite a few. So we've come a long way since punk, hip-hop, and reggae were considered worthless forms of music. Today, a lot of schools around the world are offering music business programs and technical training and courses on a variety of modern musical genres, along with traditional degrees in performance and musicology. The center will obviously do these things, but our mandate is to live outside the confines of musicology. It's a somewhat new and fresh approach, I think, to music studies. We'll try to fully integrate music into all aspects and all courses at the university. So let's say in an American Studies program, I've given this example to before, if there is a course on the Great Depression, our job will be to try to find Dust Bowl ballads, offer them on the website, offer lyrics, offer streaming video, audio, anything that we can do to make the course a little more interesting, a little more lively. And we've already done work with providing music for the operating theater and recovering rooms at Presbyterian Hospital. So a wide range of uses, any use the university or the faculty can come up with to integrate music, we will provide. So we're there at their beck and call. And we choose the projects though, that we want to engage in. As mentioned, we only collect commercially recorded materials. To date, we haven't had the facilities to properly preserve anything else, field recordings or any at-risk materials. This will change with our merger with Columbia. They maintain, along with New York Public and Princeton, a recap facility in New Jersey. It's one of the largest environmentally controlled storage facilities in the world. We're able to house 7.5 million book equivalents. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I guess it's something this thick. So we can get probably six albums for every book. And there's plenty of room for expansion at this facility. From the very beginning, the archivist collected two copies of each recording. And this was sort of a joke with a purpose, that we're like Noah, we collect two of everything. And the reason was to make sure that we had a really good copy, but also eventually to split the collection. We believe that if you have it in two places, you have a better chance of preserving something. Each of these locations could then be also collecting two of everything. And the dream was a compass point strategy where we would have an arc in every hemisphere. As each collection grew, there'd be the possibility of another satellite. And by saving duplicate copies of original material in multiple locations, even in this digital age of possible millions of copies, we believe we have the best chance of preserving this rich cultural heritage. So at the same time we began speaking with Columbia, this is very fuzzy and for some reason it moves, I have no idea why. We began talking with the National Libraries of Singapore. to create something we called Arx Asia. We were originally approached by them to work on a rock and roll collection for a traveling exhibit. And then we started talking to the libraries and shifted the focus that, and creating a partnership where we would collect music from the Asian region. This way we'll create a world-class collection in Singapore that would be mirrored both in New York and there of the music of South India, Madagascar, China, Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, Cambodia, Burma, Vietnam, Korea, Japan, and the Philippines. Again, this is a project that's developed over many years, and it only works because we found the right people who could actually push projects forward in each of these areas. Our partners in Singapore include the National Heritage Board, the National Arts Council, Compass, which is the Composers and Authors Association, which is a great partner to have, the National Archives of Singapore, and the National Library Board. And in 2010, Arx Asia will replace the current Performing Arts Library called the Library at Esplanade, which is situated right on the bay across from all the new casinos in Singapore. The space already has an exhibition space, a performance stage, a practice and screening rooms, offices, and material storage areas. So Singapore will provide us a prime location and the funding, and the archive will provide a representative collection of American materials, plus all the attendant books and duplicates when they're wanted. Basically, Singapore wants everything digitally. People there are not into objects. It's a very modern society. That you go into the library and can get songs downloaded to your phone as you walk through it. So it's a very different situation to deal with. The archive at Columbia will initiate scholarly and performer exchanges. We'll have joint databases and work on web developing projects together. Engage in building boards, again, to support this effort. We've already got Singapore Airlines online there. And explore public initiatives, including concerts, exhibitions, conferences, and symposia. By placing the Arx in these different locations, we hope to collect music that we could never get locally. We've also tried to do a European location, and this has been the hardest. I've been to dealing with France for 3 years, and I get a lot of nice lunches and a lot of nice meetings, and we've never gotten anywhere. So it looks like we're going to be in London, and that'll happen this fall. We've been offered it's sort of a third model, something that is different from what we do in New York. New York office will be part of the university. Arx Asia will be a government-supported project, and the Arx EU is a foundation started through the massive donation of materials, more than 1 million recordings from one collector, and all of his resources he's willing to donate to get this thing started. So this model has a lot of long way to go, and we're a little wary of it because, again, it's one person, and he has that postpartum thing about giving all of his records away. So we have to work through that. But it's an incredibly quality core collection to start. Tens of thousands of rare recordings, high percentage of things are signed, hundreds of thousands of 78s, singles, and LPs. So right now we've become a charity in Europe, and we're working with, again, creating a board of advisors. We always think this is really essential to have well-known people with deep pockets to support the project so it isn't constantly seeking funds from governments or other agencies. And we hope that by the new year, this could all be put in place. The archive will contribute about 100,000 duplicates to this British collection, and hope that we'll also then in exchange get their duplicates from this point on. The final Arx we want to create is about from Central and South America and the Caribbean. I've been visiting Cuba 4 or 5 times recently to see if this is possible. As an American organization, and as an American, you can understand it's kind of difficult to get them to understand what we're trying to do. But Cuba is the mother of the music in the Americas. They contribute more styles and genres and dance moves than any country in the world. Plus, they have over 100 years of really serious scholarship that accompanies this unparalleled musicianship. So after numerous trips, we're to the point where they're willing to let us renovate a building, but not own it. And we have to decide if that's a risk worth taking. Okay, quickly, to cataloging projects. In order to make sense of all this material, we've created and maintain an important group of intellectual assets and databases. merging with Columbia will present some problems of integration, but we think the primary goal is universal access, to take the cataloging that we've done and make it web available to anyone, but to make it work more like Amazon and Google and less like Library of Congress, where you can get all the information on one line that you need is essential. You'll make a decision if you need to see the next screen, but hopefully on the first screen, you'll know whether you need to look at the second screen. And I think that's one of our major goals. Right now, you can go to the web and see a beta version of one of our databases called the New York Musicians Index and Archive. The NYMIA lists information on musicians, the recording industry, and any music business offering career support, including labels, aggregators, publishers, managers, venues, but only from people in New York State. But the shell could accommodate literally any other large database, and we're going to make the shell available to anyone who's interested. Any university or state government could take it and within a couple months fill it in and be able to offer this similar kind of service. Okay. Right now, the database has about 12,000 entries in it, but it's only a beta, and we haven't announced it. When we announce it and promote it, we believe we'll have 150,000 working musicians and music-related people from New York State in this database that are easily accessible. So you can type in luthiers from Syracuse, and you'll get a list of people that can help you repair your lute or play. Another accessible project was done in partnership with the Internet Archive in San Francisco, where we've taken 4,000 of our comedy records. And I don't know if you know the Internet Archive, their job is to save the internet. And Rooster Kale is part of the Commons and the open sourcing network. And so right now there's about 100 things up, but we've scanned the covers of the 4,000 recordings and given them and set up a small archive in San Francisco of all of the comedy duplicates. And basically, they will have them all available online. Right now, you can see a short, little sampling of about 100. We're going to start again. Maybe we'll just turn this off. Anyway, so our association with a large university will allow us to access resources we've really only dreamed about. Coupled with the various locations and the diverse collections, we envision a wealth of new and, we think, exciting projects. I'm going to just do real quick again. Are we okay? Yeah. I'm rushing, sorry. The first project we'll work on is building a timeline and an archive for the Apollo Theater. The Apollo has been in existence, I think it's going to be either their 75th or 80th anniversary, I'm not quite sure, after Carnegie Hall, arguably the most important theater in America. Sadly, over the years, through either neglect or theft or a variety of ownership and little thought to preserving their own history, they lack any archive and any documentation of their history of any sort. There are a couple books out there. They do and touch on a lot of things, but there's not much. They don't even have a simple collection of the programs or a list of the performers, who performed when and what they performed. So our timeline will be based on a calendar. We'll provide a comprehensive listing of performers and what they did on any particular date over the past 75 or 80 years. This will be a jumping off point for collecting physical objects that will correspond to every appearance. We'll also train local Harlem residents in various skills that would accompany the project. And the idea is to put young people on a college path and a career path leading to jobs in either computer technology, design, archiving, musicology, theater management, direction, choreography, stage management, or even performance. So these are the kind of projects we're being asked to do by Columbia. Not just building a database, but integrating the community, creating something, in this case a permanent collection, that didn't exist before this, and also only work on things we think are culturally important. So projects like the Apollos will allow students at the university also to achieve some real-world results and provide for a wide range of academic departments at the university to make contributions: Black studies, entertainment law, again, library science, preservation, history, and even all the people in the performance fields. And hopefully this will create an exciting way for all of these components to work together. Our most important database that we've maintained over the past 20 years are those defining musical instruments and genres. We'll next concentrate on making these genre data, probably the genre database, available. So far there are 3,000 entries. The model will be a one-line wiki that will be given away for free, sort of, let's say, like Juju music, you would say Nigerian, Yoruban, urban, guitar-based, African music. That would be for free, and then we would have and put a lot of effort into creating very, very detailed, complete information sheets, essay size entries, sound files, complete discographies and libraries. And again, I can show people some of these that have already been done on the, I think it's 3,100 entries. And this would be available to libraries and universities and other archives. Every entry will be footnoted, so you'll know where there are mistakes, you'll know, and essentially be able to create a de facto bibliography on every genre. Another exciting project we hope to begin next year is the Islamic Music Initiative. ARC's most recent board member is Yusuf Nador, and he'll help build a collection of Islamic recordings from the greater Muslim world. His last recording, it was called Egypt. It explored his youth music that he learned in Senegal. It's performed with a string orchestra from Cairo, and it presents a positive alternative to Western preoccupations about Islam. So while our holdings from West Africa are strong, we have over 100 releases by Yusu. A lot of those are cassette-only releases and never been in any other form. We have an amazing collection of Algerian rye, and we've just started building a rap collection from Marseille. And again, new immigrants to France who have been performing music in various Berber languages and other languages. So now we'll make a more focused effort to collect music from Indonesia, North Africa, Central Asia, the Near and Middle East. Currently we have about 2,500 recordings in this area. Our idea is to grow this collection, create greater knowledge about this music, and create a permanent knowledge base with internet access. To do this, we're going to ask all of you to help with something we call a crash course. This is our idea is to catalog all the Islamic records in the world in 24 hours. So it's a simple project. Okay, so it stems from the idea of teach-ins in the 60s where everybody got together and tried to explain a subject in one day. And what we're going to basically do is we envision 100 people in a room at computers and 100,000 people online. This will be a one-day only staff that will catalog existing materials, research existing collections, download cataloged materials, compare entries that are sent on the same recording from different sources, contact artists, producers, copy data from printed discographies, go through existing and historical record catalogs, any and all yeoman's work to get the data in place. I think this will be fun. I think it might work. And working with us, we'll have the IT department at Columbia. Their job will be to interpret all of this electronic data mess and make sure the information can flow into a common pool. Fact-checking materials will be our staff and musicologists and experts from the university. Pre-planning will involve existing the services of major collections. I've already talked to a lot of universities. The Bibliothèque Nationale is very interested, the BBC, the Sound Archive, National Sound Archive in London. We just had a first talk with UCLA. I think we can get a couple hundred schools all involved, if no other reason, to just pay attention to this music for a short while, and perhaps at the end of the day, we'll have cataloged maybe 25,000 things that weren't cataloged the day before. And even if it doesn't work, it ought to be a lot of fun and provide a model for maybe doing this later with other styles of music. Real quick. Okay. And then obviously, the last thing we want to do is make sure that our cataloging, the 800,000 things we've already cataloged, will go online. And I can't do that myself, and that's something we definitely need Columbia to do. To sum up, we have a lot of stuff. We really love what we're doing. Most of the projects we're suggesting can be done without grants. Just do it. And hopefully in the next 2 years, you'll be able to see all of our stuff online for free.
There's much that's been cheering in this session. The only thing is, he doesn't know he's talking to a room of people who have three copies of everything. We're out of time. Questions they will take if you'd like to stay. Thank you so very, very much.